Doubting Thomas. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you guys have a 3-year lectionary. You're AALC, right?
Yeah, we're on the 1 year right now.
On the 1 year? Do you do like 3-year, 1 year, 3-year?
Mm-hmm.
Nice. See, I might have to get into that. That sounds like a really nice idea. I like that a lot.
Yeah. But last year we did the 1 year as well. The only reason I know that is because Joe had me preach this exact Sunday last year.
Oh, okay. Nice.
Because it was the exact same text.
Well, that's good. And then you get your feet wet. Well, it's my first year in the ministry, so I'm three years ago, and I deferred for a year. So 3 years ago, I was on vicarage, and I preached a lot on vicarage.
Yeah.
And so all the readings are the same. And so if I'm really busy, I just pull my sermon from when I was a vicar, and I edit it so it doesn't suck, because it probably wasn't as good 3 years
right.
ago, you know. But I basically just kind of pull up my old sermons a lot of the time as a reference. So that's nice. And then
that's what I was going to do. I was going to just rework last year's, because I did the about Thomas, because, you know, we call him Doubting Thomas, but like he wasn't like, well, you know, I'm not too sure, you guys. Like that wasn't that isn't what he said. He said, I don't believe and I will never believe.
Oh, yeah. Oh, interesting. I have a kind of an opposite take. Interesting.
Yeah.
Okay.
So he wasn't doubting. He was unbelieving.
Denying. He was like flat out denying. Oh, interesting. Okay. Yeah. I might have to sprinkle that in tomorrow. So my main point is that I kind of have the other perspective. He gets a bad rap. Like we call him Doubting Thomas, but literally all of the disciples, you know, constantly put their foot in their mouth. Like,
right.
You know, Peter, we don't call him like, you know,
brash Peter. Well, I do.
Or no, not even like denying Peter, right? He denied the Lord 3 times. That's like his big thing. We don't call him denying Peter. We don't call James and John like, you know, whatever you know, they're trying to like usurp Jesus's throne. He's like, hey, I'm going to die. And they're like, okay, sweet. Which one of us is going to be in charge now? We don't give them a nickname for like, oh, they're trying to, you know,
old mutinous John.
Yeah, yeah. They're throwing, you know, a military coup to overthrow Jesus.
Right.
But here's the reason I give Thomas a little bit of grace is because in the end, when Jesus comes in, Jesus says, all right. And he quotes Thomas's words back. He says, here, go ahead, touch my hands and my feet, you know, put your hand in my side, just like you wanted, so that you can, you know, have your proof. And what's really cool is the text doesn't actually tell us that he touches it, and it kind of indicates that he doesn't. And so, like, I think it's cool. I like to call him confessing Thomas, because Jesus says, "All right, here's all the proof you need." Thomas says, "Nope, don't need it. You're my Lord, my God." And he just kind of does it at Jesus's word. He doesn't actually like do any of the inspection that you expect.
Mm. I'm going with, since I did Thomas last year, I don't really want to do like the same thing.
Okay.
So I'm going with the beginning of the text, and even a little bit of the text before, a little bit of the resurrection, like Easter text, leading up to verse 19. And I'm going with that the disciples, the first thing the angel tells Mary at the tomb is fear not, and then go tell them this stuff. And so Mary goes to the disciples and says, hey, good news, we don't have to be afraid, Jesus is alive, he's alive forevermore, hallelujah, amen. And they all collectively say, we don't believe you, and instead of not being afraid, we are going to go be very afraid. I'm going with Jesus is dead, and they're worried about the people that killed him, that they're going to kill them too. And worse, Mary comes and says, hey, good news, Jesus is alive. And they're all probably thinking, good news, that's terrible news.
Oh, because we abandoned him?
We left him to die.
Yeah, he's going to be so ticked off.
So he actually is God, and we left him to die.
Yeah.
That's awful news. We do not want to see Jesus. We want to hide locked away in this room out of fear of judgment, out of fear of condemnation. We want to stay away from this. And when Jesus shows up in the room, what's the first thing he says to them? Peace.
Peace, right? Yep. Yep. Same thing.
The first thing he says to them is absolution, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Beautiful.
No, that's good. That's really good. I don't know if I've ever, I don't think I've ever taken it as, you know, oh, they're in fear of, you know, basically getting scolded, right? Like, oh, Jesus is going to be mad. But I'm sure that was part of it. Like, I think they still doubted, like, oh, I don't think he's alive. But yeah, if he is, that's not 100% good news either. Yeah.
Right.
Interesting.
Yeah. Yeah. The God who sits in judgment is alive now and forevermore. That's horrifying. That's like, that's absolutely terrifying.
Well,
you know?
And if they actually have the capacity to remember, you know, going back, like, wait a second, actually, he kind of told us this was going to happen. Oh, shoot. He told us like 20 right. times.
And we did not believe him.
Man, we weren't listening. Yeah.
Yeah.
Crazy.
That's my favorite disciple thing is like early in the ministry. Jesus will tell them something, you know, beware the leaven of the Pharisees, you know, for a little bit ruins the whole loaf. And they all sit around going, who brought bread? Did you bring bread? I didn't bring any bread. And Jesus is like, no, guys, no, it's like an allegory. Like I'm speaking in like a cryptic way
right.
to get a point across, you know, but then like later on, he's like, listen, in 3 days, they're going to kill me.
Yeah.
And they're all sitting around like, what allegory is this?
Yeah,
and Jesus is like, he's like, no, guys, no, this time I'm just telling you this is.
Yeah. And it even spells it out for us as the reader. It's like, it's basically saying like, in other words, like just to make sure the disciples get it, he explained it to them again privately and like spelled it out with a PowerPoint. And, you know, here's my bullet points, A, B, C. And yeah, they just, they don't get it.
I got to preach on the parable of the sower some weeks back. And,
oh, nice.
And I made the point that, you know, the only reason, like, as you come across the parable of the sower, and you're like, oh, yeah, I know what this means. You know, the stony ground and the seeds like faith and the thorns and the cares of this world and the path and the good soil. Yeah, I know what this means. But I was careful to point out the only reason you actually know what this means is because the disciples asked Peter.
What does this mean?
Peter was the only one to go, was the only one brave enough to be like, hey, Mr. Jesus. And asked the question. And then John or Matthew or whoever, thankfully, wrote it down. And that's
right. Exactly.
That's the only reason you're clued in here.
Because he explains it. Well, yeah, that's the other thing we have the advantage of is he's telling these parables and we have multiple accounts of the same parable sometimes as well, right? Like it'll be in two or three of the synoptic gospels. Mm-hmm. And like, you know, yeah, the disciples got to hear it more than once typically. But like, what about everyone else? Like, you know, Jesus was talking to this crowd. He's talking to this crowd. Not everybody until it was written down was able to like, oh, I can actually sit here and read it from three perspectives. And oh, yeah, it makes a little. Now I get
it.
Oh, that's wild. Yeah.
Yep.
They don't always get. I preached my first parable here. I've been here like at, 10th month or whatever of ministry. I don't know. Not quite a year. But I realized I was preaching my first sermon on like straight up just a parable text, just preaching the parable. I think it was the prodigal son like 4 weeks ago or something. For whatever reason, I just haven't had a parable, hasn't been a text I've chosen until then. And so I got to basically the first 10 minutes of my sermon was just talking about like, how should we even read a parable in the first place?
Right.
And that's fun because it's, for me, and I don't know where I learned this. I don't remember if it was seminary or just a classmate or something has said to me, like, you know, when you're reading the parable, just, you know, look for the bad guy. And that's who you're supposed to be in the story. And I think it is because like, it's really easy for us to be like a good Samaritan. And like, I've heard that sermon 1,000 times, like, you know, you and I are supposed to be the good Samaritan. It's like, well, yeah, but we're never going to be able to. The point of the story is, you know, we're either the guy beat up on the road or we're the, you know, the snobby people walking by, not helping the poor.
Or the robbers that beat the guy up.
Or were the robbers who beat the guy up. Yeah, yeah. And my buddy, he told me, he said, the best possible outcome for that parable is not that you're the Good Samaritan. The best possible outcome is that you're the ass, you're the donkey being used by the Good Samaritan to carry the guy to the inn. Like that's like best case scenario.
Yeah.
Is, you know, you're being used by the Good Samaritan, because that's Jesus. Like the good guy in the story is never you and I. God, that's God doing his work. So you're right. The bad guy. And yeah, it's easy not to do that though. Like, I don't know, you read a novel and they want you to identify with, John, everyman, good guy protagonist. That's who you're supposed to read into, you know, but that's not us.
No, it's not.
Nope.
It's certainly not me.
No, absolutely not.
So, what seminary did you go to?
I went to Concordia Seminary, St. Louis.
St. Louis?
Yes, indeed.
Okay. The good one.
Yeah, that's what they say. I say they're both good, but
that's what I say, mean. Yeah.
I know.
It's whenever anyone says one or the other, I always say the good one.
Oh, nice. Nice. That's good. Well, then you get a sense of like how they feel about it. They're like, yeah that's exactly.
I think it's just that from an outside perspective, I think the Fort Wayne guys care more than the St. Louis guys about the whole thing.
Which one's better?
Sure. Yeah. I think the Fort Wayne guys are still kind of hung up on the Seminex thing.
That's been my perspective. Seminex is still happening, you know. It's about to happen. You know, they let women read during an interpretive reading of Matthew, and, you know,
right.
Therefore they support, you know, women's ordination. And so, you know, we got to get there and, you know, clean house.
I think that I've met tons of graduates from both seminaries.
Oh, yeah.
And I think that Fort Wayne produces more theologically rigorous pastors. But
I've
think,
seen that.
Yeah, I think yeah. St. Louis produces, not that Fort Wayne pastors don't love people, but St. Louis seems to produce pastors that like love people. You know,
I've seen good and bad come out of both. And, you know, I have more experience with St. Louis because I saw it, you know, firsthand. But I have classmates who were, you know, 10 times the academic I was. And I wasn't academic hardly at all. So but then I know guys from Fort Wayne that are just the most, you know, chill, relaxed, you know, easy to talk to people. And so, you know, not everyone fits the stereotype, but, you know, there is some truth to the stereotypes. Absolutely. Yeah. For both sides, for sure.
So you've been doing this for 10 months.
Yep. Almost a year.
Nice. So there was a sabbatical period, I guess, between your graduation and your first call.
Yeah. Yeah. I guess you'd call it a sabbatical. Yeah. We deferred for a year, amidst COVID and all sorts of other stuff. But we basically, so deferring just means I'm graduated, checked my boxes, and we're just waiting a year to take a call. And so we took a full year. I was working. My wife was still in college. She is still in college right now. She's about to finish. She's graduating in December. We just lived an extra year in St. Louis, and I was like,
okay,
I was doing a bunch of different jobs, and we just kind of hung out for a year, and it was a good time. And then we got a call at call day last spring.
What kind of stuff were you doing for work before ministry?
Before ministry, I've done it all. I'm kind of like a jack of all trades, I guess. I did most things I did were in the IT field. I mean, I did a lot of cable pulling, and I worked in the IT department at college and at seminary. And I had a job for 6 weeks. I had a job at a prison. That was fun.
Oh,
but IT still. I was like installing a security system for like emergency panic buttons for like visitors to the prison.
That's neat.
That was my last job right before seminary. That was really fun. So it was this like government contract job. I don't know how I got it. I got recruited for this job. They were like short staffed and they found my name somehow. And I got a phone call and they were like, "Hey, you want to make $40 an hour?" And I was like, "Well,
yeah,
I guess." Like, all right.
Yeah, I do.
I was fresh out of college, 23. And I was making like, I graduated one semester early from college. So I did college in 3.5 years. Just to try to save some money, graduated early. I was working some job for like $13 an hour, get this phone call. And I'm like, well, I'll tell you right now, yeah, I want to do this, but I'm only going to be there 6 weeks. Do you still, like, I was very upfront, like, still want to hire me? And they were like, oh yeah. So they were desperate, I guess. So I
did you get it done in 6 weeks or
no? The project, I came in part with a project had already been going on for like 2 months. I got there, I worked for 6 weeks, I left, and they continued, you know, finishing the project. But no, it was awesome. So yeah, like, huge break for me. I'd never had any sort of like well-paying job ever. And so like, you're 23, 40 bucks an hour. And I, from, like I said, from day one, I was counting down, like, and my coworkers knew it, like, I'm here work, you know, working like crazy, working hard. But you know, 6 weeks, 5 weeks, 4 weeks, counting down, I'm out of here. I'm going, you know, going to go be a pastor. All my coworkers were like, nah, man, you're making too much money. Like, you're not going to, you know, you're not going to quit. You can't give up a cushy job like this. You know, you're making, you know, we were only working 4 days a week. I was making 80K a year, you know, whatever the salary comes out to, like, and so they just kept saying that. I was like, I felt like almost, like, you know, one last attempt from the devil, just like, yeah, you know, maybe you don't need to be a pastor. Maybe you can just, you know,
work in a prison,
work in this prison for, you know, not for, you know, that was just, that was not just forever. That one contract. But yeah, that was a, that was definitely a road I could have gone down. So instead I went to a bunch more school, took on a lot more loans, and now I'm making a lot less.
Great.
Woo. But it's good. I love the ministry. It's a lot of fun. So
I
all sorts of jobs.
I don't think he believes me yet. I've been going to school specifically to get to SIM.
Sure.
You know, and now here I am at the point where I'm getting ready to enroll or apply or whatever. And he's still, you know, talking about, you know, well, son, you need to, you know, do this and that with your retirement at your current job and, you know, this and that, and make sure you. And I'm like, Dad, you know, I'm only going to be at this job for like another 18 months. And he's like, well, I know you say that, but the healthcare, son, the healthcare.
Yeah, okay. that's great and all, but.
Yeah. So why the ministry?
Oh, man, that's a great question.
Yes, it is.
Yeah, it's good. Most of my life I wanted to teach, go into education, be a teacher or a professor at the college level. Wasn't really sure. But I always had an interest and a love for, you know, theology, biblical languages, just, you know, doctrine, you name it, church practice. I just was really involved in the church my whole life. And so it kind of was on my mind, like, oh, maybe one day I'll go and teach and I'll be able to teach at like a Concordia or at a Lutheran high school, some sort of upper level Lutheran institution. And so that was kind of always on my radar of what I wanted to do, was go into some sort of education, teach Bible class, theology, you name it. And my dad just kept telling me over the years, he's like, you know, if you really wanted to work at like a Concordia or, you know, teach, you know, you kind of have to have an MDiv. You kind of have to like go to seminary. You know, they don't just, you know, and to an extent that's true. Like I could go get several degrees other places, but like, you know, if you look at the, you know, looking back, this is very true. So if you look at Concordia Ann Arbor, like, all the guys that are on the theology staff at Concordia Ann Arbor, they're all pastors.
Right.
You know, they all at least, you know, have an MDiv. Whether or not they were in the parish, some of them were for sure. One of them might not have been. But, you know, these guys, they're a pastor and then they like go teach, you know, early on or half, you know, partway into their like tenure, I guess, as a pastor. But I still kind of was not really putting it, in the forefront of my mind. I really didn't think I was going to be a pastor, but another person that really pushed me towards it is, the oldest member of my home church. She just passed away recently at like, she's 100, 103, 102. Wow. She's super.
That's awesome. There.
Oh yeah. She's great. Her name was Frieda Blackwood. She was, always very supportive of me, always talked to me every Sunday. And she always said, you know, oh, you should consider being a pastor. And she just kind of said that to me like every week. And I was always just like, no, no, not really. But eventually
those
I did.
Those church, you know, ladies, man.
Yeah, yeah, for real. But she just, oh, I love seeing you up there helping acolyte. And then I was older and like, oh, I love, you know, hearing you read. And I honestly, I'm just like, I'm loud. I just have a loud voice. And I think she just liked me being a reader because she could hear me, as opposed to a lot of the readers are, you know, they kind of put their heads down and whisper and they're nervous. And so it's kind of hard for people to hear. So she was an old lady. I think she liked seeing me up there because she could hear me talking just because I was, you know, vocal or whatever. But yeah, so she just kind of kept pestering me about it. But just every week she'd ask about like, oh, have you considered this? And so eventually I thought about it and I was praying about it. And I did a couple, what are they called? I think this is a terrible name marketing wise, a Taste of the SEM event.
Oh, yeah.
Doesn't that sound fun? Taste of the SEM. These word choice. These things are thought up by people in their 30s and 40s. And
yeah,
they're not thinking about like the high schoolers that are attending these events and how like weird these things sound. But awesome event. Awesome event. Yeah. I went to that a couple times and just kind of got to be on campus at the seminary in St. Louis. And it was cool because like the seminary paid for everything. I think you were responsible for like getting there, but it was like you got to be on campus for like 3 days and they housed you and fed you and, you know, you shadowed a seminarian and, it was a good time. Yeah.
So I tell you what, if I were a seminarian and I had a high school kid shadowing me for 3 days, I would be very upset.
Yeah. I didn't sign up for that when I was a seminarian. So I got to experience the benefits. But
I'm not giving back.
Oh man. No.
Here's the thing. I love a public road as much as anybody, but I'm not paying taxes.
I don't like, I pay my taxes. Jesus told me to, but I don't like it.
It's not fun.
Yeah. Jesus said I had to pay him, not that I had to be happy about it. So yeah, same kind of thing. No, that was not for me. That wasn't for me. I'd probably end up, you know, giving some 16-year-old kid a beer and, you know, smoking in the parking lot or something dumb. You know what I mean? Like I get in trouble. We'd cause problems or something.
That's great.
Yeah. Seminary was fun. It certainly was. If that fits the stereotype of St. Louis being more like chill and, you know, whatever. I think they goofed off a ton at Fort Wayne too, but yeah.
I think everybody goofs off when you're in your early 20s, right? Like it's just kind of,
exactly.
It's what you do.
And there are some academics. There sure are. I had classmates that took it very seriously and, you know, and I learned a lot obviously as well, but at the same time, one of the people I follow on Twitter, the hipster Lutheran, he was a classmate at seminary. Yeah. And he and I have talked about this. He just tweeted about it recently. There's your cat. Yep. He just tweeted about it recently. He was saying like, you know, if someone basically is saying like, yeah, I've got an MDiv, you know, I went to college to be a pastor. Therefore I have like this educational thing where you got to listen to me, you know, what do you call it? Like I've got the degree. Therefore I know what I'm talking about. It's like, I have, you know, so much homework that I didn't do and things I didn't learn and classmates where we're goofing off and like some of us took it, you know, super seriously all the time and you know, lots of pastors out there that
some of us passed.
Some of us passed and there's a pastor shortage and we might have squeaked through. So you know, it's one of those things. So yep.
At the same time though, I have to say, sometimes I'll be talking to people like online, and this happens on Twitter mostly, or in like a stupid Facebook group, where someone will say something like, I've been studying Christianity in depth for years, and I know that it's wrong because blah blah blah, and I definitely know more about this and have studied this more than you. And my default response to that, people always say that, I've studied this more than you.
Yeah.
And my default response every time is, where did you get your doctorate? Because unless like that's where you're at, right? Like I'm going for an MDiv. So you've got to be beyond that to tell me that you've actually studied it more than me, right? Yeah. But at the same time,
right.
Yeah. But at the same time, like you can be smart without a degree too.
You can. And you can get a degree.
A degree doesn't Exactly. A degree doesn't mean smart. A degree means a degree.
It means you filled out the paperwork and you sat in the room and you mm-hmm. turned in.
You gave an institution $25,000 or more. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely.
See, this is a debate I get into all the time. And I know the LCMS has a like a program, like a vocational program for pastors. But I think it's wild that we have in conservative Lutheran circles tied something that is of the kingdom of God,
mm-hmm.
That is the vocation of pastor, of prophet, right? We have mm-hmm. taken this vocation and we have tied it to the worldly institution of American higher education.
Yeah.
In such a way, like if you're 40 and you've been a plumber and your dad owned a plumbing business and you used to tag along with him, and then you bought his plumbing business and you're like a master plumber and you've been doing it since you were like 14, and you don't have any school on you at all, but you run a successful plumbing business, and then you decide you want to go into the ministry. You yeah. have some kind of radical tower experience or what have you, and a big St. Paul moment. You want to go into the ministry. Like, I don't think it's fair to make you start at a community college and spend the next 8 years of your life going all the way through yeah. an MDiv program. Like, yeah. like, surely, what do you need to know? You need to know church history. You need to know, like, the languages. And I'm not saying we shouldn't educate our pastors. We should. Sure. But, like, I had to take an elective in modern art or, like, art history.
Art history, yeah.
Yeah, like, does that... Does a deeper understanding of the 60s music movements of rock and roll, that's an elective I took. Is that really going to help me? Like,
it's just one of those things where we're certainly not operating in the best practice, but I also don't know what the best practice would be. I really
right.
don't. You know, there's something to be said for education and allowing, you know, to have formative years.
Mm-hmm.
But you also could just push the age limit. You don't have to tie it to the degree. You could say, like, you got to be 30. Yeah. You got to be 30 to be a pastor.
Or and, we could.
You know, I don't know. And you have to have the X, Y, and Z. But it doesn't have to be 8 years of school. You can go, you know, study under a pastor and shadow him, which sounds like that's kind of what you're doing with Joe. Like, you're yeah. kind of shadowing a pastor for however many years while you're doing other jobs, and then you go, you know, go do 1 year of school or something, and then.
Yeah. Yeah. And like, why can't, let's say it is 6 years of school, but like, why do we require you to have any kind of undergraduate degree? Just enroll in like special pastor school that's disconnected from the American higher education system. And I know that we can't get our accreditation and we can't get our government loans and all this other stuff that we get. And I feel like that's probably a lot of it. But that's
part of it. Yeah. The degree inflation is crazy. I was trying to explain to my elders the cost of my education, and they like, mm-hmm. I don't think they get it. I was like,
no,
on paper, my degree cost over $250,000.
Yeah,
and they were like, well, I don't know. I'm like, no, really, like, we can go look. I'll show you, like, you know, tuition, room and board, books, everything. Like, yeah. And then I got all sorts of scholarships and grants because all of that inflates with it. So, you know, the costs get multiplied by 10 in the last 40 years. And so does all the financial aid. But let's say I didn't get, you know, if I didn't get any aid and I didn't apply for scholarships and I didn't get this or that and I got denied for loans, it's like I would just never be able to get this degree and I wouldn't be here right now.
Yeah.
And that's it's wild.
It's mind blowing. Yeah.
Yeah.
There was because ALTS is not accredited yet, they don't care if your undergrad is accredited. Nice. And so there is the Carolina College of Biblical Studies, and it mm-hmm. is a pretty decent sized college. It's a Bible college. We're in the South. We have those here.
Yeah.
And it's pretty well known, and they have a really great online program. And I was going to be able to go and get a bachelor's degree in some kind of theology.
Sure.
It was some kind of theology specific thing that would basically set me up for a master of sacred theology. Like that was the goal, was that you finish this program and go and get a master of sacred theology.
Yeah.
And I was like, great, you know, that's perfect. And I was all ready to do this. They were going to handle all of my undergrad. And so I was getting ready to enroll. And so by the time I decided on it in the spring to the time I went to enroll in the fall, over the course of that summer, they got accredited.
Oh, and then
and the cost went from $300 a class to like $2,000 a class overnight. That's and I ended
outrageous.
Up. Yeah, I ended up doing all of my work at Bladen Community College.
Okay.
And then where the government paid for everything, literally all Pell Grant paid for it.
Right.
And then,
my wife gets a bunch, has gotten a bunch of that. Right.
Oh, yeah. And then I moved over to Liberty to finish out because Liberty University was cheaper.
Yeah. It's outrageous.
It's outrageous.
And you would have gotten, you know, perhaps the theology you learned at the Bible college, some would have been good, some would have been bad. You know, you got to take the meat, toss the bones, but it would have been more like edifying towards ministry. It would have been like, you know, learning about actually learning about theology and stuff, you know, for a couple of years.
Yeah. And they're all Baptists and Presbyterians at that, at that college, but they're all also very well-respected theologians. And they're every single one of them is a parish pastor.
Oh, that's nice. They're not just disconnected. So, yes.
Right.
A lot of the seminary professors are great. And some of them you can kind of tell have not been in the parish in a while. So it's a little bit.
And there's a difference. There's a difference, too, I think, between being in the parish and being just in the pulpit.
Oh, yeah, you know? Absolutely. No,
like
no,
anyone, for sure. Anyone can get up and just like preach a sermon and lead DS3 on a Sunday or whatever. It's a different thing to be there on a Tuesday when someone calls you about, you know,
whatever,
a personal tragedy or needing grocery money or.
Yeah. You know. Yeah, absolutely. Oh, oh man, that's crazy. So what all do you do for Joe? You're almost like a vicar. It seems like you do all sorts of stuff with him. That's great.
Yeah, pretty much. Pretty much. They, actually sent me the vicarage requirements. Some time ago.
What's the seminary you're going to be attending?
American Lutheran Theological.
Where's that at? I don't know.
Fort Wayne.
Oh, that's right. I did know that actually. Okay. So they exist on Fort Wayne's campus.
Yep.
Got it.
Cause the LCMS lets us base the AALC's headquarters is there. So.
Oh, wonderful. Oh, so you're
on
like
campus,
Fort Wayne based. Okay. That's great.
Yep. And then a lot of our seminary professors are Fort Wayne guys who like pick up an extra class or two with us, you know, things like that. So it's very good. I mean, we have our own professors as well.
Okay.
But, you know, sometimes we'll get some of the guys at Fort Wayne to drop in and do a class or two. So it's pretty good.
So what's the main difference then between you guys and the AALC and the LCMS? Like I know some of the nuances between us and Wisconsin, and I know the fairly major differences between us and like the ELCA, but I'm not as familiar with the AALC and
I'm probably not the best authority to talk on this. I think Dr. Cooper did a video on it.
Oh, cool. Oh, of course I should. Yeah, he's your most famous Lutheran.
Chris Roseborough, actually, I think is probably our most famous pastor.
Is he AALC? Mm-hmm. See,
yeah,
I didn't
even
know that. I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So no, it's I know there's some difference, I think, in the organizational structure.
Sure.
So I guess we're an association of Lutheran churches is what we are.
Yeah.
We are, I guess each church you could consider to be independent, right? And they're in association with one another AALC.
It still sounds like us. We have districts. Do you have districts?
We have regions.
So it's the same. It's just the same thing with different names. Like, oh man. Okay.
Yeah. I think our call process,
right?
I don't really know how our call process works, but I think it's a little different.
Okay.
I think we probably vest a bit more authority with the congregation in the call process. But I don't know how ours works and I don't know how yours works, but Yeah. Like, I'm pretty sure. I don't know if I'm going to get in trouble for this. I'm pretty sure that, like, if an AALC church wanted to call some woman heretic to be their pastor, like, they could do that. They wouldn't be in the AALC anymore. They would most certainly be kicked out.
Right. That's the same thing. No. That's the same thing here. So, like, okay, this is the thing that I was trying to explain to somebody, and they thought I was crazy, but, like, it's true. Like, so let's say my church, they decided to dissolve, my congregation. They were like, hey, you know what? We're all going to just close the church, you know, shred the charter or whatever, and we're going to just go other places. If my congregants at a voters meeting voted to sell the property, all the money goes to the members.
Oh.
Right? Now, what usually happens, this is my understanding of, like, how I'm reading stuff, that the district typically comes in and says, well, could you just basically hand it off to the district so we can use those funds to basically provide ministry to this region? But as far as I've seen, I think on my vicarage church, when I read their constitution, is the same thing. It's like the congregation kind of is the end all be all. Similar example for you, like, oh, yeah, mm-hmm. they could vote to, you know, hang me out to dry, and they could just call, you know, anyone. And yeah, the district can come in and say, well, you're not going to be part of the LCMS anymore.
But, right.
You know.
But as a congregation, you have every right to do that if you want, I guess.
Well, yeah. And I think that's pretty biblical. I don't know if it's the best practice, but it's definitely biblical. And in many ways, I'm jealous of the Catholic model for certain reasons.
Yeah. Yeah. It's I like the idea of just putting someone somewhere. The Methodists do that too. So it's interesting. A buddy of mine was a youth pastor at a UMC church, and this is the South. We're very conservative here.
Mm-hmm.
There are a few churches around that have, like, Pastor Deborah or whatever. But outside of some denominations and stripes, that's not very common.
Sure.
And so the UMC owns, I guess they own, like, the land or the building or whatever. And they pay the denomination as a whole pays the pastor whom they install.
Oh,
the congregation then funds everything else at the church. And if, like, the congregation wants to call a youth pastor, like my buddy, he wasn't a Methodist, but they called him to be their youth pastor, and that's fine. And the thing is, because the pastor of the church doesn't, he serves the church, but he works for the denomination, not the church. So he can't make hiring and firing decisions.
Okay.
So they called my buddy to be a youth pastor, even though he's not a Methodist. And like it or not, the head pastor couldn't do anything about it.
Wow. And so that associate pastor can, like, as long as he doesn't, you know, tick off the congregants who hired him, he can teach whatever he wants. And the head pastor gets no, like, wow.
Yeah.
It's very weird.
It was wild, because my buddy was, like, super charismatic and probably not at all a Methodist. And then the guy that ended up replacing their head pastor, he came in and he was all, like, he wrote a whole book on why LGBTQ inclusivity is so important for Christianity and how we need to start ordaining gay marriages and gay priests and all this. And he's, like, big push on this progressive Christianity, and Christianity has to change to the times. This was the pastor that they installed in this church, the UMC did, here in the South, where that kind of thing just doesn't really fly like that. Him and my buddy butted heads all the time, but the congregation liked them both. And so, you know, the UMC wasn't removing the head pastor and the congregation wasn't firing my buddy. So,
oh my goodness.
They just tried not to be at the office at the same time.
that is wild. I can't imagine. I honestly can't imagine. That seems crazy.
Yeah. Yeah. It's pretty crazy. there's we came out of the ELCA, mm-hmm. and the ELCA has a similar model where they own, the denomination owns not all of them, but they own a lot of the churches themselves.
I see.
Or the property. And yeah, so
ours is definitely congregationally owned.
Yeah, which is good, because so like our church, thankfully, it depends on, I think, where you merged in from when the ELCA formed. But they own a lot of the property. So when people try and leave and say, well, we don't agree with your teaching and this, you know, Nadia Boltz-Weber lady or whatever, we want to go to the LCMC or the LCMS or whatever. The ELCA says, well, that's fine, but you're going to need more land in another building because we own this one. Right?
Yeah. Now, so there are upsides and downsides. So I think that the downside of, you know, the congregation owns the property is something that I think I tweeted about this a while back, was basically like people that like essentially worship the building or worship the property or it becomes an idol, right? And so, okay, so in my area, we're in South Suburban Chicago. So like I'm 45 minutes hour south of downtown Chicago. So I'm in suburbia. But where I'm at, there is just a ton of Lutheran congregations, a ton of churches. Many of them are dying, I would say most of them. And not just our LCMS churches, just all the churches. You know, populations are moving around. People are just, you know, constant, you know, suburbia and urban flight and just all sorts of craziness. So these churches are just drastically dying or moving. And so there was six Roman Catholic churches within like a couple mile radius,
right?
Which is a lot.
A lot.
Again, they were, you know, they needed that many, however many years ago, right? So the Roman Catholic Church came in, and this just happened like less than 6 months ago. They came in, the bishop or archbishop of Chicago, whatever, comes down and says, all right, you're closing, and you're all going to go over there. And then you're closing, and you're all going to go over there. So these churches were all basically drowning, dying, and the church came in and said, nope, we're not going to let that happen. We're going to take these six churches, we're going to combine them, and they're going to just be two churches now. Mm-hmm. And you're going to bring the priests together, and they might have relocated one or two, but they bring the priests together, they bring the congregations together, and they kind of consolidated to keep these areas. They don't need six mm-hmm. churches. They, you know, there's
right.
not that density anymore. So the downside with the congregational model that we have is, let's say, and this is happening not with my church, but with a group of churches nearby. You know, these pastors are looking at the same kind of idea. There's like these three churches, and they're like, man, we're all really struggling. Let's see if we can convince our congregations to basically merge and come together and kind of form one church in this small town instead of three, where all three of us are worshiping 40, 50. Let's all just get together and have one church. The hard part is if you can't convince the voters, then they're going to, if they want to dig their heels in and say, nah, we'll be fine. Even if we're only worshiping 30, 35, like we don't want to share, we don't want to work with this other church. They vote no. And then it just dies and it just won't happen. And I see that as like, that's the other side. That's the danger is these congregations sometimes have a very like, it's, you know, our history, our building, you know, we can't work together. It's all about us. And since there's
not, our building's been here for 106 years. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Or 60.
And a lot of times too, when you merge two churches together, instead of getting one church, you get three.
Yes.
Right. Because you have the holdouts from the original churches and then you have the new merged church.
Right.
So yes. St. Peter and St. Paul merged together into St. John.
Yeah.
And you got the St. Peter holdouts, the St. Paul holdouts, and then the new St. John.
Yeah.
That's messy.
It is messy, and it's unfortunate. And like I said, I don't know what the best practice is for most of these things. I just know that the model we have, it works, but there's some downsides. So, that's the kind of thing that's going to have to happen, even at my own parish down the road, whenever that is. You know, it's like they're going to have to either work together or, you know, figure something out, or, you know, we can't afford a a giant bill. I think a lot of churches have this problem. We have this massive property that like was built when we were worshiping 1,000, you know, back in the 60s, 70s. Wow, yeah. Oh, it was a powerhouse, you know, and it was like they were worship 3 services, 2 pastors, and like over 1,000 people on a weekend. And now we're worshiping like, you know, 80 to 100 on a weekend, which is not bad numbers. But the building was big enough for 1,000 right. active members. And it's like, well, wait a second, we can't afford this, you know, just to, you know, keep the lights on and keep the building maintained.
See, I think so. Here's my take on this. Our church building, according to the fire marshal, our sanctuary can hold 146 people.
Oh, wow.
Okay. We get 60 on a Sunday. Not bad.
No, that's okay. So almost half. Sure. Capacity.
Yeah. There were times. So we sit on, I think, 5 or 7 acres. We sit on a pretty big property, but the building isn't too big. And there was a time where we were discussing, this was long before me, back when the church was still ELCA, discussing building a large building, an auditorium building on the back half of the property because the church was getting 200 something people every Sunday. And they were like, hey, let's build a bigger building to accommodate these people. But I don't think that's the right answer. That's what a lot of churches do is they say, oh, we need a bigger building to accommodate these people. No, what you need to do is if your capacity is 150 people and you have 200 people coming every Sunday, what you need to do is take 50 of those people and figure out like which 50 people live farthest away from the church but near each other, and then go plant another church over where those 50 people live so they don't have to drive, you know, 30 miles across town.
Yeah, exactly. Let them be a community church because that's what we're supposed to be, is the church in the community, right?
Yeah. So that's what, and I'm thankful at our church now. That's kind of the way we're looking at it. We have no interest in building a larger building. We own the building we do and the land outright. It's ours. You know, we just pay like the taxes or whatever and move on. Yep. So we're, I don't think we're interested. In fact, we planted a bunch of fruit trees out on that back nine where they were going to put that other building. And we've got a big community garden and all this stuff. And, you know, I think the goal now is if we do get to that size again, to split and plant a new congregation.
There you go. You know. No, that's great. That's beautiful. As long as your active membership is able to, you know, maintain the facilities and afford to, you know, to pay the pastor well enough and all that stuff, then like, yeah, there's no reason to like.
We pay Joe too much. Oh my gosh, he's got me doing everything.
Yeah, for
that's
real.
Not true. I barely do anything.
Yeah,
we don't pay Joe near enough. He's great.
He seems like a good guy.
He is. He's a good dude. He's a good dude. What was the one thing that scared you the most about going into ministry?
I'm not sure. I think just like the least experience I had was like, actually, funerals. I don't know that they really scared me as much as I was like, I was just nervous. I was like, I don't have any experience with this. So I had this wild vicarage where during my whole year of vicarage, no one died. I was at a pretty big church, like 230 on a weekend, you know, anywhere from 175 to 250 on a weekend, you know, 2 services, real active church, lots of old folks too. Seriously, not one funeral the whole week I was there. Like the week after I left, I think 3 people died though. Like they were waiting. They were like waited. Yeah. Oh, it was crazy. So no funeral experience at all. And so then, you know, getting into ministry, I was like, oh man, like I had stuff from my supervisor on vicarage, basically like, here's a funeral plan of like what to follow when someone dies, you know, here's a checklist basically. And I have other pastor friends who are in the area and I would, you know, email them and say, hey, like, can you just give me some info on funeral prep? And I asked seminary professors. So I had lots of, you know, academically informed knowledge, I guess. Right. So then my first week on the job, you know, 35-year-old father of 4 kills himself. You know, military veteran, suicide, young guy. Like, and it's like, oh, okay, you know, worst fears realized. I've got like not only like a funeral, but like this crazy, like, I had to work with like it was like a secular quasi-religious funeral at the, what do you call it? Like the Veterans Hall? No, no. Mm-hmm. What do you call it? Something outpost.
And like, yeah.
I'm not a military
Veterans
guy.
Of Foreign Wars, VFW.
VFW Hall. Yeah, yeah. So there was like a funeral service at the VFW, but they still wanted me to be there. And then, I had to navigate this crazy like funeral, and I had a whole bunch of funerals like right away. So I think that was just God helping me, like, you know, kind of get
through
it.
Here you go.
Yeah, yeah. But it you know, it doesn't freak me out anymore. But that was certainly a thing I had. I just had almost no experience, you know, dealing with like end of life stuff.
Was there anything that you were like super confident about, and then like that confidence evaporated, or you were proven correct in it, or you're like, oh, this is the thing I know how to do. And then it happens and it's like, oh,
as a white man living in America, I have a lot of confidence in pretty much anything, right? It's just, you know, just walk in and I know how to do it. No.
You're in the world.
Right. Exactly. No, I don't know. I had a really, really good vicarage, great supervisor. I learned a lot. And so I had a lot of confidence just from that year of experience. I would say going into vicarage, I was pretty much like, I don't know anything. I'm ready to learn, which is a good attitude I think everyone should have, is like, just, you know, get ready to learn a lot. But vicarage was great because he had me preach and teach. They basically treated me as an associate pastor. So I really got my feet wet, like from, you know, day one. It was, you know, had to memorize all my sermons. I taught every Bible. I think we had four or five Bible studies a week, including confirmation, in the men's group, women's group. Excuse me. And so on every other week I did everything. So I was teaching multiple Bible studies every week and preaching. And so 2 to 3 times a month, I was doing everything, all the hospital visit. Every month I also did all the visits. So, you know, my supervisor did all the shut-in visits. I did all the shut-in visits, alternating. And so, yeah, when I got to ministry, it was like, before vicarage, it was like, oh man, I'm going to preach a sermon and I'm going to spend weeks worrying about it. And like, oh man, you know, really nervous and I don't know what I'm going to do. And, now, like, I'll probably get judged. I don't spend more than 2 hours prepping a sermon and Bible study for Sunday. Like, that's right. Like the least of my worries in the week. That used to be like the big thing that I was worried about. Vicarage gave me a lot of confidence in that, being able to quickly put a sermon together, quickly put a Bible study together, and have it be of decent quality. And then, you know, if I have spare time, I can spend a lot more time on it. But usually I don't, because this week alone, I drove 270 business miles.
Wow.
Shut-ins and visits and, you know, hospital. Yeah. Like, oh, man. So, yeah, I don't got a lot of time to sit in the office and work on my sermon. I just kind of got to whip it out fast and get back
to
ministry.
Have you ever been in your clericals on your way to or from somewhere and stopped? Like, in your clericals, someone comes up to you and they're like, oh, hey, Father.
Oh, I don't wear my clerical that much. I wear it for like Sunday mornings. I wear it for funerals. I wear it for hospital visits. If I'm having trouble getting into a certain facility, I'll wear it to make sure I get in. I had some trouble the other day. And
does that work? That works when you show up in a clerical and people are like, oh, hey.
It depends. Usually, and honestly, if you just kind of walk in and just ignore security, they usually don't say anything. But like, I had I had some instances. This is true. This is crazy. So like, I think I actually tweeted about this a while back. I had two members who both suddenly were in the hospital a few months ago. Mm. And I went to go visit them wearing my clerical and everything. And the front desk like wouldn't let me in. One of my church members is on the board of the hospital. She's actually the chairman of the board for the hospital. So I was like, you know, oh, I'll show them. I'll call up my member and they'll, you know, get on this. But, you know, being on the board of the hospital doesn't mean what it does on TV. It's not like, right. you know, I can't just name drop them and like do whatever I want. I wish. But eventually I was able to get into the hospital. But in the meantime, during those days where I couldn't get in, one of those members died.
Mm.
And it was like, and it is a member who I had not been able to visit, who like wouldn't allow me to visit her at home. And finally, like she's in the hospital. It's like, okay, perfect. I can actually go visit this person because she'll allow me to visit her in the hospital, even though she right. wouldn't let me into her house. And so like, it was like my one opportunity to actually go visit with her and like bring communion and stuff. And they basically just were like, no, you can't come in. And it was just like some random person at the front desk deciding that, even though that wasn't the hospital policy, it was a bunch of nonsense. And I couldn't believe it. Yeah. It sucks. Yeah. But so like the collar helps, but it doesn't always get you in the door. Yeah. But no, I have had people call me father. Back to your other question. People do call me father. Sometimes I usually don't care enough to like, oh, hey, like I don't,
right.
I don't argue. It's like, you think they would see the wedding ring and be like, oh, maybe he's not a Catholic priest since they can't get married.
The EO guys go by father.
The who?
The EO guys, the Orthodox guys, they go by father.
Yeah, and they can be married, you know, the Greek Orthodox, mm-hmm. Byzantine. Yeah. Yeah.
And I like the idea of father as a title for a priest, just for the. Because, I mean, that is kind of as like a shepherd of the congregation. That is kind of where you're at, you know, like the father of these people, you know, in that sort of leading and guiding role.
Sure. No, and I mean, even in undergrad, I had a professor who kind of taught us like, you know, here's the biblical basis where it's not wrong to call a pastor father. And it's like, yeah. And for me, it's more of just like, what does that denote for the people?
Yeah.
And it's one of those things that unless you have a lot of education on it, everyone's still going to be like, wait, I thought we weren't Catholic. And it's like, it's just not worth it.
Not worth it. It's no. I saw a discussion on Twitter about we should go back to calling it the Mass. And Pastor Feeney was like, no, because it would be harder to reclaim the word Mass than it is to just get everybody to say divine service and move on.
Yeah. You know. Or just call it church or worship.
Right.
You know, yeah. You know, yeah. Again, it's like, what's the best practice, but you know, what's our main focus? That kind of stuff. Like, sure, there might be a better or worse way to do it, but I think that's like the 100th thing on the list of important things that mm-hmm. we need to be working on.
Yeah. So way down the line.
Oh, it's so far down the list, but that's the stuff everyone's arguing about. And it drives me nuts. I really try to be as much of an idealist as possible. And it's like, you know, trying to get my congregation to, you know, work on the actual, you know, top 10 just, things that, you know,
just read the Bible, please.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. 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 Bible illiteracy is awful.
Please. You don't even have to read it if you don't want. Okay. You can download the Bible Now app or whatever it is, the Bible Gateway app. They have the entire Bible narrated in story form if you want to mm-hmm. listen like as an audio novel.
You could do you could read the Spark Notes version. The Spark Notes of it is really good. It is. You should read the – if you want to get – like Easter Vigil service, I was preaching on Job and the I Know My Redeemer Lives. I literally mm-hmm. was using the Spark Notes thing of Job to kind of like basically build my –
yeah.
Like sermon intro on like the backstory of Job. And I was looking at it and I was looking at the text and I'm like, man, they did a great job. Like, this is awesome. So yeah, you're right. Yeah, exactly. Why don't we worry about the things that really matter? You know, let's start with, you know, what did Jesus want us to do? Okay. We got to love the Lord our God with all our heart, mind, and soul and love our neighbors as ourself. You know,
right.
Let's go do that. Let's start there.
Yeah.
Let's do nothing else but just focus on that for like 3 months. And then if we have any time left over, let's worry about all the other things.
One of the great things our church does is, so Joe likes to grill.
Yeah, nice.
Yeah, so we do every Thursday, we just grill out, or every other Thursday, we grill out.
Oh, wonderful.
I'm up to the church and grill out. And our church is literally in a neighborhood, and that neighborhood doesn't attend our church. And like, right. that's my only goal. I don't want to change the county. I don't want to change the city. I don't want to change the world. I just want to get this neighborhood that we're in the middle of to attend our church on Sunday. Like, that's my goal.
Absolutely.
And those people show up on Thursday, man. They'll show up for some hamburgers and hot dogs. I'm trying to convince, we don't break out the beer, but I'm trying to convince that, you know, just bring a BYOB, just bring a beer. It's okay. You can have a beer and a hot dog and we'll hang out.
Yeah.
We got a fire pit. It's great.
I'm trying to establish my congregation into doing some stuff like that, because my congregation, I think this is the case with many churches. It doesn't reflect the neighborhood anymore. Doesn't reflect the immediate community. And you've stopped being the church. If all you're doing is coming to the worship service, you're not actually living like the church. But I think most people see, like, oh, so, you know, I come Sunday morning. And so like that's the thing. That's why we call a pastor. He's here to lead services. And it's like, well, yeah, that's in my job description, but that's like,
it's like
what, 10% of my job, if that.
Yeah, it's like weirdly the smallest part.
It really is. Like,
Well, and like you talked about, like 2 hours, you know, 2 hours max to throw a sermon together and get the thing, you know, presentable for Sunday. So like, I don't know how long you typically preach. At our church, it's between 10 and 20 minutes.
Yep, that's and about, I do 15 to 20.
You know, even if you mess it up completely, there's the Eucharist at the end. So... You know, they're still going to get it all anyway, you know?
Right, right. And if you're doing the service in a standard way, there's, you know, you got your Bible readings, and so they're hearing the Word of God. Even if I do a bad job of preaching, which I hope I'm not, but even if I do a bad job, they're still hearing the Word.
Yep.
But like, if that's the main tenet of my job, then why do I work 50, 60 hours a week on all this other, you know, nonsense if, you know... Oh, it's supposed to just be the worship service? Okay, wow. Well, then I guess I really only do work. I guess I do only work 2 hours a week or whatever.
Like, right.
You know, whatever that dumb joke is. Like, okay, if that's what you really think my job is supposed to be.
Well, Pastor, it was great having you on, man.
Oh, I appreciate it. Thanks, Remy.